when you have a culture of, you know, respect, you know, and inclusion and valuing people's opinion and give people the space to share and communicate, then not only do they feel more empowered to do their best work, but also then you see the results of the company as well. Those, you know, been fortunate enough as well to be in a couple places where I've seen the benefits of it.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Keep Moving Forward, the podcast from X Team for tech professionals who are passionate about growth, leadership, and innovation. I'm your host, Caleb Brown, and in each episode, we'll dive into candid conversations with the tech industry's brightest minds, seasoned leaders, forward-thinking engineers, and visionary experts. Today, I'm joined by Brandon Lonick, Vice President of Software Engineering at Disney Streaming. Brandon's career spans more than two decades of shaping the way we consume media. He helped pioneer video on mobile phones in the early 2000s, and now he's leading Hulu's expansion, driving integration and innovation at Disney+. In this episode, Brandon opens up about the lessons he's learned scaling engineering teams, balancing autonomy with standardization, and building systems that hold up under millions of concurrent users. We talk about how respect and simple human decency, things like saying please and thank you, form the foundation for strong technical cultures. Brandon also shares why communication and curiosity are at the top of his priorities when hiring and mentoring engineers. If you've ever wondered what it takes to lead at the intersection of media, scale, and technology, or how to keep teams grounded while moving fast, this conversation delivers. Let's get into it. Thank you so much for, you know, agreeing to join the podcast and be a guest today. Super excited. Obviously had an opportunity to dive into your background and everything, and really interesting stuff. You've tackled a lot of, you know, just fascinating problems, big problems. And I'm excited to dive into that today. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, I'm excited, Caleb, to be here.
Awesome. Cool. And then, yeah, maybe we could just kick things off with, you know, you kind of walking through your career journey, sort of what sparked that interest in the world of media and streaming technology.
I've always been interested in working in software that would help impact people's lives. And I started off right in college and just after college building database-driven websites for various companies, and like real estate website and travel companies and school districts. And it was exciting, but I was just lured by working in a space that could really impact people's lives and media. I had the opportunity early in the 2000s to find my way into a company that was delivering video over cell phones. And that I was just hooked. I just loved the idea, like, oh, you know, that was after Napster. And, you know, like the wonder what's going to happen with media at that time and video. Will similar things happen? And so I'm a huge movie fan, and it was just so exciting to me to be able to have an opportunity to work in an environment where we could potentially be part of the transition from traditional media to whatever it looked like, you know, at that time. Now we know, you know, 25 years later or so.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. And I was going to bring it up, the platform. You know, you were part of, you know, like you said, pioneering those efforts to put video on mobile phones. And so I thought maybe we could dive into that a little bit more, you know, what it was like developing that technology that was so ahead of its time. And I'm sure you'll kind of set the stage a little bit, but let me do that is that, you know, I was looking into the platform and I truly believe I had heard of it. I've followed startups most of my entire life. But I mean, that company started, I believe, in 2000. You joined a few years later. And so you're thinking about delivering media on cell phones at that time. You know, it wasn't years later that we even got streaming on something like Netflix. So that it was so almost a decade later. So that's just such an interesting time. So yeah, maybe you can dive in just a little bit more about that, you know, that time at the platform.
Yeah, it was very exciting. I feel very fortunate to have, you know, worked with a couple people and had connected with prior companies and just connected with them at that time and that point in time. It was 2004, I think, 2003, I think, when I joined. Yeah. And I was brought on to help bring small, you know, one inch by one inch videos to flip phones. Like at the time, that was all the rage to have a flip phone and a Motorola Razr and all those kinds of those phones. It was large part of that. The biggest challenge was two things. One was actually getting the phones to play the video. I recall there were some challenges with the OS and just even the capability of the phones at that time, you know, as well as just so many integrations that we had to do in order to make the content available and get it to connect into the cell providers. There was a number of integration challenges that I had not been exposed to yet in my professional experience and the other startups I'd worked at. But I started to learn about how you would connect various systems to each other, what it would look like to have contracts that were easier for systems to connect with and stable. If I recall, there was a lot of iteration. And so then there was a lot of churn at that time as well about how to get information into the cell carrier system and then we could make everything connect at all. So that was my first real exposure as well, not only to like a direct consumer facing experience that definitely was different and revolutionary, but also starting how you piece large software systems together. How do you think about systems that can scale, especially when they are servicing and powering consumer experiences? So it was a few years later where that work where at the platform has started to support a number of large consumer brands, you know, bringing video to websites and things. And the challenges that you have to solve and face when you really are supporting brands that are directly supporting consumers. And so you started to learn that you can't always plan for what users are going to do. And if all of a sudden, you know, there's some breaking news or something, everyone wants to see it, right? And so then you start to deal with, you know, how do you build systems that are scalable and can handle stampeding herds, so to speak, and traffic and while keeping experience up. So yeah, those are some of the big things from that period that I had to work through and feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity to help, you know, others and solve those problems. And
100%. No, that's super cool to be involved with, you know, that kind of streaming media at that time and to see the evolution of that over the years, of course. Switching gears just a little bit, you know, I think on our prep call initially, you had mentioned sort of the importance of treating everyone with respect, always saying please and thank you. And of course, a simple approach, right? What we tell kids early on, but I was still struck by it and thought it was very interesting and want to know, kind of dig into that a little bit more and kind of talk about how that impacted your leadership style.
It's a good question. I attribute my manners to my mom. There was always, Brandon, always say please, always say please, you know, and really from her, just really learning the value of respecting everybody. Doesn't matter, you know, who you are or who they are, what they do, everyone deserves respect. And that really has impacted me over the years as I've moved into more leadership roles. And I think it translates. One thing I found is, especially with hierarchy of roles in companies and whatnot, is that there's a perception that it's easy to have a perception that, you know, you don't necessarily need to say please to people. Right. If you're a higher role than they are or lower at, and I've seen it myself and witnessed it. Like there's a breakdown in some ways of almost social manners or norms sometimes. And I've also experienced that that leads to a less than ideal culture where people don't feel safe or they don't feel comfortable sharing ideas or communicating. And I've seen. And like the result of that, like it may seem silly, I think, to put effort into the kind of communication because we are in software and technology and things like that. But I've seen material impact or negative impact to some of the companies I worked at over the years as a result of that. But I've also seen the flip side, right? Where when you have a culture of, you know, respect, you know, and inclusion and valuing people's opinion and give people the space to share and communicate, then not only do they feel more empowered to do their best work, but also then you see the results of the company as well. I've been fortunate enough as well to be in a couple places where I've seen the benefits of it. And it, very like firsthand. So it's a lot. So they go back to a lot of validation, I think, from attribute to my mom, you know, instilling some of those basic manners in, you know, with me as I grow up. But then now also be able to see just the impact and personally, you know, in times in my life when generally I try to always be polite, you know, and respectful of people, you know, and I'm going to ask some questions, interrupt time or whatever. But then also reflect on times, you know, when I've not done that myself, you know, in certain situations. And then later on I don't feel so great about that interaction. And I reflect on it and like, I don't think I was treating them with respect, you know, and that outcome was harder. And it wasn't a great outcome, I think, maybe for anyone, like, you know, so draw on some experience to, and as you validate that. In general, yeah, better to treat people with respect and always say please and thank you. There's positives on the outside of that for doing that.
100%. Yeah. And so obviously very important when talking to humans, but that reminded me of something I just saw, and I don't know if this is true, but I just saw something online that said that being mean to like LLMs, like coding assistants improved their coding ability. And that bummed me out so much. I hope that's not true. I hope if that is true, we can fix that.
Yeah, I've not seen that, but I agree. That kind of bums me out.
Me too.
I hope that's not true or remove that.
Yes, I hope that is the next AI technology is making them work when you're nice to them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Let's take the good things that we do, not the bad things.
That's exactly right. When hiring for your team, I wanted to just kind of ask you what you're looking for in their responses.
It's a good question. And at this point, over the years of interviewing lots of people and things, I really look for people's ability to communicate their ideas, communicate their decisions. And when I'm interviewing, generally for the position, usually it varies a little bit on the position, but in that case, you ask that question, what's been hard and how you solve it and get their, to gauge their input as well. So, how well can they describe the solution? How well can they describe their opinions about it, communicate about it? Yeah, usually through those kinds of questions and information, you can tell how involved they were, whether or not they are, you know, whether they're overstating or not. Because I find as well that just asking people to explain, well, why did you choose technology X versus Y? There, you can usually find out about how passionate maybe they were about that decision. And I actually will. As well, I play devil's advocate. So even if I agree or maybe someone, you know, like, oh yeah, that's, yeah, X is clearly the right choice there in that case. Also, well, why did you choose Y? I've heard Y does, maybe it's 20% faster, you know, play devil's advocate a little bit. And I'll do that as well to just to help gauge their, you know, how people respond and or if they're able to communicate again, like articulate about the ideas or maybe they get flustered. I've talked to people in the past where asking them basically the counter question, like, well, why did you do that? You know, and pushed on that a little bit. They get frustrated and they don't necessarily respond super well. And I do this because I generally believe that communication is such a large portion jobs as, you know, technologists, as engineers, that it's all about communicating with your team members and other people as a majority of it. And then written communication, you know, over the course of a workday, week, month, years, is naturally going to be some conflict. There's naturally going to be a disagreement with your peers. And how do you resolve that conflict? And so to me, like that, I found over time at trying to ascertain someone's ability to communicate and their, and how they respond to maybe asking, well, what do you mean? I disagree with you. That's really my goal. And I've found that to be pretty effective, I think, in helping to build teams that you know, helping to pull people together that are already good at communicating and sharing ideas and to resolving conflicts. So,
absolutely. That's helpful. That makes sense. You know, we've talked a little bit about communication now on and teams and things like that. And, you know, I imagine some of the earlier companies you started with were smaller, but at this point in your career, you're working on much, much larger teams, much larger organizations. how do you kind of maintain kind of, you know, cohesive communication across such large engineering organizations, you know, and especially, you know, we're considering things like Dunbar's number of limitations, right? 150 connections. How is that at this kind of scale and how do you manage that?
I think it's really important to set expectations. Right. And make sure that people know what is being asked of them and what their guidance is. So going back to communication for a second, this is part of why I think relationships and communication is like the foundation of technology. Because if people feel safe to communicate, they'll feel safe to share their ideas. And if they share their ideas, then people will give their best work, right? They'll truly be able to communicate with people and hash out ideas and drive and deliver features and value and whatnot. And so I think that goes back to how you organize lots of people is that helping to create that safe space for them and setting their objectives, right? What are the expectations? And giving them the context and say, okay, go build this, right? You have the trust. You have trust in your teammates. You feel safe to create, to share your ideas, to experiment, to even fail, right? But to iterate, as long as people have tried as much as possible to give, you know, here's the expectation, here's the outcomes you're looking for, that creates the space for them to build in that and fill in the gap, right? I think going down and having to be very specific about giving detailed instructions to lots and lots of people, that's just time consuming, right? And that's it's a recipe for disaster, you know, that gets towards full waterfall and things, processes. So, I mean, I think the key is, you know, setting expectation objectives. I think this is where OKRs are great. Making sure teams know, like, this is the top line goal. Here is the key metric that we measure against. And then, you know, if teams feel safe, go implement, go meet this goal, right? Work to meet that goal and iterate in your smaller group. And checking in on progress of those OKRs, I think, is critical, which then also is to make sure that everybody knows what they are, right? You got to make sure that everybody knows this is what we need to do. But it's also important to say why. I think I love Simon Sinek and his perspective about that. You know, always start with or begin with why. It is so important. It's so true. And like having that bit of information of, you know, why this is important to the business, why it's important to our users, why is it important to maybe the team itself? Like we have to improve our support systems or whatever, that why is super critical. And so, you know, focusing on why it's important, setting the objectives, the high level goals, and make sure people understand that, and then give them the freedom and the space to deliver within, launch features within that framework, I think is the keys to large organizations.
That definitely makes sense. I did want to just dive into that a little bit more because I'm wondering how you kind of balance standardization across an organization while you're still giving, you know, teams and individual contributors to some degree the autonomy to solve those problems, you know, in their own way.
So my experience over the years in technology, I think there's really only a couple things that you really have to standardize on. And I think there's probably lots of things you could standardize. And I know there would be levels of benefit to more standardization or not, but it reduces freedom. But I think in terms of like, what you really need to standardize on is like, how do developers release their software? How do they deploy their code? Like just the process about releasing and sending out features, I think it's super critical to have as much standardization as possible, like in that build pipeline, in the release process, you know, CI/CD, like all those practices as much as possible standardized, because those are things that meaningfully impact not only the business, but also the users, right? And experiences, like users come to expect to use your product. You know, and any downtime down to those products, it really impacts them. So I think, you know, standardization around deployment, build processes, obviously I think support, like PagerDuty type, how do you interact with incidents? How do you engage teams? Like you can't like send a text to one team and send a Slack or email to another. Like you either have all the same communication standards there. And then, you know, as well, I think it's, There's a size in your company as well where you can have teams can be autonomous in what they choose to build. There's like what technologies, what languages they use, what data stores they use. But I think when you cross a certain threshold in engineering size, that's also too where you need to standardize a little bit on what languages are used and what data stores that are as the backbones for the technology stack and things.
No, that's helpful. I'm glad we went into that because that's interesting and very helpful. And I've yet to work on a team that large. Probably the largest engineering team I've ever worked on is maybe 10 folks. So it's interesting to hear the perspective of such scale. And speaking of scale, you were part of Hulu's growth at around like 5 to 6 million subscribers, all the way then up to tens of millions. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about what was sort of the biggest technical challenge there of scaling, that you faced from that kind of growth perspective, which is a lot of people.
Yeah, it was. The largest challenge, I think, has been over the years supporting a live linear system. Linear is different. It's so much different from just regular VOD, video on demand, or YouTube, or you're just watching clips at a time, or maybe individual shows or something. But linear is still, it's connected back into the traditional broadcast media infrastructure. And so because of that, you're still limited by how the broadcast companies operate, as well as you have a connection into consumers' expectations for how linear should work and what you should look at, how it should, what they should see and interact. So those are two hindrances that kind of, they shape a little bit of how technology, how you have to build it and then deal with scaling it and new features to bring it to, a product like Hulu. So.
Yeah. So when kind of staying on that topic a little bit, when leading the integration, Hulu into Disney Plus, what are some of the kind of complex technical or even organizational challenges that you encountered in that kind of, that kind of situation?
That actually too, a lot of the challenges in that case, this goes back to my feelings around over the years, like what do you standardize on and how do you communicate and what processes do you use? In that case of bringing Hulu to Disney Plus, there's a lot of opinions, right? Mm-hmm. And so we had to work through and create, identify which opinions needed to be sorted out because not everything was important to have to resolve and hash out. But then, help folks to figure out like which ones are the most important ones to solve, and then it becomes a case of helping the engineering organization organized into a way they could complete and work the project. So, forming areas of focus. So say, this is the login side. This is the playback stream. This is the browse stream. So basically, well, for lack of a better word, borrowing from Safe, like release trains, right? Create various release trains for the different types of work that need to be completed. And that most of the challenges were making sure that those, like say, release trains of functionality were all aligning in the same direction, right? And when they had to stop and meet at the same integration points that they would, so that's the largest part around getting a lot of engineers working on the same functionality, bringing such a huge catalog and feature set like Hulu and making it available on Disney Plus. Yeah, really all about integrating and making sure the engineers can communicate at the right time.
Like I said, I've only worked on pretty small teams. So this kind of scale is really fascinating to me. What's your approach for technical debt when operating at, again, a massive scale, millions of users that are depending on your services? And, I know that people get pretty mad when their videos do not play. So they are depending on your services. So yeah, I was interested on technical debt on that kind of level.
I feel that and think that technical debt, it's used as a derogatory term, I think, in software. And I think it's used to describe usually decisions that were made by previous people who are no longer there or maybe moved on to another team, more often than saying that it's what I think is the more correct definition of it, being that it is a level of friction in the services that's a slowing down velocity of development. So like taking that lens on it, I also feel that it's a crutch, like it's used as a crutch or an excuse sometimes by engineers not to do something. I don't want to do that because it's tech debt, or it's not interesting because it's not a new feature capability. So, my perspective on it, on that way is because then you end up having these, usually I've seen over time as you get large initiatives that like, oh, you know, fix the broken windows, you know, put time towards fixing tech debt, where I really actually think my perspective is that it's an engineer's responsibility. It's a team's responsibility to always be fixing. Always be fixing. And I'll go back. This is another thing from my mom, which was, it was like, always leave it cleaner than you found it. Always leave it cleaner than you found it. Pick it up, leave it cleaner than you found it. And so my perspective is to apply that to software. So, and I've told this to the teams over the years. If you're in the code and you're fixing something, then fix something else at the same time. Like, don't just do the one fix you're asked to do. Leave it cleaner than you found it. So, You said, oh, it'll take me an hour or two. I said, well, just double that. Like, there's not that much difference in the grand scheme of thing of times, whether, you know, it took you an hour or two to do something versus 2 or 3 or 4 hours. Like, just leave it clean and you found it. And I think over time, then that it helps systems. And I've seen this as well. It can help your system stay more maintainable longer because it is operating at efficiency. You might have better observability. The teams feel confident about making changes because you probably also have some automated testing and quality, so to speak. So I think there is a threshold if you have too much tech debt and people feel that they're like, oh, that's too thing. That's the old team or it's inherited or whatever. But even in that case, I still kind of push on folks to, you know, do your best with cleaning it up. And then if there really is a point at which that's not going to happen, there's too much work to do, like maybe a large scale migration of versions on something like a data store or a large third party system or something, you have to do big migration. Those might have to be projects, but yeah, I think, but generally being positive about not using the word tech debt, but then leaving things cleaner than you found it in improvements. So.
I feel like right out of college, I joined a startup and I feel like I never learned that's not my job. Like, I feel like what has benefited me a lot is, you know, just naturally wearing a lot of hats in an organization. I think that's very cool to hear that. Yeah. If you're working on a feature or a bug and you see something else, improving that along the way and not just, you know, kind of, you know, waiting for someone else to make a ticket on that. I like that. And I wanted to ask you kind of the last question on the scaling stuff, sort of just kind of any advice you'd give to an engineering leader who was transitioning from a startup environment to a much larger organization, just any kind of advice you've had for someone in that position.
Yeah, I would encourage them to be open to learning and really be. And I think from a startup, like you just mentioned, you had wore many hats. I did startups early on in my career too. And I did the same thing. You wear a lot of hats and you really kind of learn. You can go all over the system. You can go from front end to back end. And that, I think, is really helpful for engineers to get that perspective. And I think that's then useful for transitioning from a small company to a large company, because like coming from a small company, you have to lean in. You have to say, oh, I'll pick up the trash too. It's not my job, but I'll pick up the trash. And I think that mentality of leaning in and, you know, the goal here is to help the overall business and all of our customers. The goal isn't necessarily to help your specific team and say, no, that's not my job. I'm on this big team. Like, it's all about the overall goals for the company and even in the general organization. So I would encourage folks to, you know, be open to learning, lean in and seeing how they can help the broader teams and be open to like, maybe challenging some of their assumptions that they may have. They're like, oh, this is how you build software or this is how a system scales. I think just be open to like, oh, well, maybe that doesn't always work, you know? So those would be the three top of mind things I would tell somebody.
Love that. That's awesome. Just a question or two I wanted to wrap up on, kind of a future outlook kind of thing, future perspective thing. And I just want to know, you know, you've been in this world for a while, and specifically in media and streaming media. How do you see streaming technology and even architecture evolving over the next, you know, 5 to maybe even 10 years? I know that's quite the outlook.
It's a good question. I think over time we've seen, even a few years ago, standardization in how video gets delivered, more commoditized, right? So now we have, you know, actual video delivery is pretty commodity. I think the same can be said for like experiences, like discovery, like how do you go to a website to see what you have? Like lots of brands have their own video service. And that's just a reflection of commoditizing it, of how you can show content to users. I think that trend will continue, that more and more, it's very easy for brands to just have anything they want. But I also think that in those people won't really probably engage with those as much. I think there is kind of a consolidation of brand and eyeballs, I think, of how where you can not only do users, consumers, what they'll choose and where they'll go to find their content, but then those places that they go to find their content will increase their diversity of content, have more and more things, might have more and more overlap. I think we've seen this already with like other streamers, you know, getting into live, like Netflix getting live and like Apple too. So like you're starting to see all the big players do similar things. I think that'll continue. And from a technology perspective, there's definitely going to be a shift away as well from how we deal with broadcast. I think like that's also going to start to change, you know, and then I think in terms of like scaling, like every year, like what we see now with LLMs is that it'll be easier and easier to have really high scale systems that can handle millions and millions of users as parts of those systems become more commodity in themselves, which then will free engineers up and teams and things to drive to really build the features and personalization that really is focused on their particular brand or experience or type of content. I think we're definitely seeing trends where that becomes easier. And what was a few years ago super difficult, you needed a whole, you complete your own personalization system and pipelines and your own models and teams and inference, online inferencing and all those kinds of systems. Those are all, you can get that stuff now through cloud providers, right? It's just stitching those things together. So I think the benefit there is more time to build engaging experiences, focusing on a business's particular challenge or focus that they want to solve for. So, and engineers, well, actually, last thing is internal engineers, every engineer would benefit from personalization experience, you know, and understanding machine learning and models. And that is just going to be more to focus, and having that experience in any way, even if it's, you know, whether it's, you know, actually able to produce and write a full custom model and system versus just knowing how to put the pieces together from cloud providers will be critical, especially in the next 5 to 10 years.
Awesome. I wanted to just kind of wrap it up then on, you know, you, like I said, you've had a phenomenal career, incredibly interesting. I want to know the single most important kind of leadership lesson that your career has taught you in, you know, what you'd like other engineers to know, how you'd like to kind of share that knowledge that you've learned over the years.
You don't have to be right. And when you think you're right and you're really pushing that you're right, you may be right. However, it doesn't always lead. It doesn't always end as you may think it does. So it's better to be humble. And if you're, you know, really try to understand other people's perspectives and collaborate, it's all about communication and collaboration. But yeah, the one thing is, if you think you're really right, take a step back and really ask yourself, are you sure? It's not worth really pushing.
Absolutely. Love that. I think that's a very good one too. And Brandon, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. This is great. This is great. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Great. Thank you, Caleb. Yeah. You too.
Absolutely. That was a masterclass in leadership and technical perspective from Brandon. What resonated most with me is how deeply Brandon ties high performance engineering to culture, specifically to communication, humility, and respect. He reminded us that the most scalable systems are built by teams that feel safe enough to speak up, challenge assumptions, and iterate without fear. From advocating for everyday manners to championing team autonomy within clear goals, Brandon has a way of grounding big technical conversations in very human truth. And his point about always leaving the code cleaner than you found it? That's the kind of ethos that doesn't just scale products, it scales teams. Brandon's insight offers a clear roadmap for anyone navigating leadership at scale, from building resilient teams to cultivating the kind of culture where people and ideas can thrive. Join us next time for more insightful conversations with tech leaders who inspire us to grow, lead, and innovate. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube Music. And don't forget to share this episode if it resonated with you. Until next time.